Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're talking climate action denial. It's a bit different than just climate denial. It's actually climate action denial. It's gotten to the stage, guys, where we're looking at it now how it's being reported and how the debates are being formatted, where we're really struggling to see why people are debating what actions need to be taken. So it's like the science is now unequivocal. Climate change has been accepted, but let's not actually do anything about it. Speaking of not doing anything about it, my co-host, Martin Meatfree McMahon is here.
I was just going to say, I meet 7 days a week, Tony. And you're dead right about this. You can't come out one day and say reduce meat and then come out the next day and say I'm going to eat steak 7 days a week. You can't do it.
Much more importantly, we're delighted to join the Tortoise Shack by self-described freaking out and speaking out campaigning journalist on climate change and sustainability, John Gibbons. John, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Cheers, Tony. Cheers, Martin.
I'm going to kick us straight off. And I suppose the big question is, John, what is it about this existential crisis that made you think you should be doing something?
Yeah, I guess I'll put the question back and say, what is it about this existential crisis that anybody thinks they shouldn't be doing something about? I don't know how anybody thinks they can sit this one out, because, you know, everything's on the line and much sooner than people think. So from my point of view, you talk about climate action. I think about climate inaction. What a weird time to stay on the fence on the biggest issue of our lifetimes. So yeah, I find being a climate activist, I'm happy with that label. What the people I'm puzzled are people I call climate inactivists.
Yeah, well, that's a very fair point.
Who would be the climate inactivist?
Just about 98% of the population. And if you move into the political classes and into the public service and into big business, make that 99%.
That's scary.
It's really scary. And as Tony said in the outset, you know, the science here is unequivocal. I mean, to put this in numbers, you know, the science, you know, on climate and dangerous climate change. And climate change is a strange phrase. We've kind of started using climate breakdown as a far more accurate way of describing it, because climate change sounds like, you know, tire change, you know, it's something that happens and it's natural. There's nothing at all natural about the phase of rapid climate disruption that we're heading into now. Sorry, that we're in now and that we're heading into the really deep waters. So from my point of view, you know, I think it's quite extraordinary to consider that we have got so much of our public service, so much of our political classes. What they've started doing is they've started making the sounds. They're mouthing the words.
Yes.
I remember Enda Kenny in 2015, he went over to Paris and he said, the clock is ticking, the hand of history beckons. And I thought, gosh, how moving. I needed to reach for a hanky. Mm-hmm. 5 minutes later, he's telling the political hacks, don't mind that old bollocks, it'll be grand. Business as usual, lads. Don't worry. And I'm not making that up.
No.
That is pretty much what he said. So he's talking out of the two sides of his mouth. And that's been the way we are in Ireland about things. We take this sort of, well, we're only schmal, lads, and let the feckin' Chinese sort it out. And we've decided collectively to sit this one out. And it's not an option in my book.
Now, you said the clock is ticking, and the clock is ticking. We're looking at three, if you want to put it in perspective, three general elections from now, the clock will have passed the deadline date.
I know I use the phrase myself, I'm a little worried about setting deadlines like 5 years and 10 years and 12 years. You know why? If you say to a politician, we've got 10 years to save the planet, you know what they say? Brilliant. Get back to me in 9.5.
Yes.
They when they hear 10 years, they go, fantastic. That's 2.5 election cycles. Next, please. What they're worried about is the guy who's kicking their door down today. So if you start talking into the middle distance, their eyes glaze over.
But we are looking at something that needs to be acted upon now to effect a change within 10, 15 years.
Absolutely. Well, let's be honest, it needs to be acted about 30 years ago.
Yes.
To effect, you know, to have given us a chance to ramp down while keeping most of what we currently call industrial civilization intact. We wanted to be ramping this down when the scientists told us 20 or 30 years ago that the shit's about to hit the fan. Unfortunately, we decided, well, actually, we're just going to go for business as usual. In fact, we're going to ramp it up. So we've had, like, since the turn of the century, we've had the most intense period in the history of industrial civilization, the most resource use, the greatest level of emissions. And I mean, the head record for me is that if you take, say, the last 30 years, this is the period in which we've understood the science. In that 30-year period, we've emitted more carbon dioxide and other gases into the atmosphere than in all of human history up to that point. Now, that's That's mad.
That is staggering. And, and I have heard that statistic. It was one of those, well, you know, take the Industrial Revolution, multiply it by a factor of 1,000, multiply that again, and then you're saying what we've done in 30 years. Mm. And it's in that period where we can't claim to not know, where, you know, we've had the climate denial, we've had the Heartland Foundations and all of these institutes set up to push back, we've had all of this big business. But in Ireland, what we still have is lobbyists and industry that push back as well, because we know, and case in point, you were recently on Primetime, and I shake my head when I think about it, that it wasn't talking about what climate actions we were going to take. It was because a school child had put a suggestion in a document for a meat-free Monday, and the IFA lost their minds.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that child really needs to be taken out of school and sent to some kind of, you know, re-education facility. To a gulag. It's absolutely crazy stuff. I mean, in fact, I was on another TV program last night and the same subject came up. And again, it was put to me, you know, this veganism, it's a big threat to our farming industry. I just flipped the question right back to them and I said, right, you know, I'm in business, like my day job is a business person. And I said, right, we don't tell our customers what to buy from us. We listen to our customers and then we provide services to match that. Mm. The farming industry thinks it can browbeat its own customers. I mean, and its customers, by the way, include vegetarians and vegans. They eat stuff called food. Traditionally, that's produced by people called farmers. So when people like that claim to be representing farmers, they're not. They're representing meat factories and they're representing dairy PLCs. Mm. They're not representing regular farmers by any means.
Mm. The well-heeled farmer, dairy is where the money is if you are a big enough farmer. But does that not speak to the bigger question that capitalism is the major block? Capitalism is the problem.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. I'm conflicted here because I'm a business person. I've been a good capitalist for nearly, well, we'll say over 25 years. And capitalism has done right by me. It's worked for me. And as a model on a sort of an Adam Smith style, small scale capitalism, it's great. It produces stuff, good jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem in my book isn't small scale SME capitalism. The problem is the big guys have taken it and basically, you know, they're burning down the world with a form of smash and grab capitalism. That's the problem. But, you know, I'm always reluctant to say, you know, there's no redeeming features in capitalism. The market has its function. The problem is the big guys have wrecked the market.
No other ideology, for want of a better term, has lifted more people out of poverty throughout human history than capitalism. Okay. But what we've seen now is it's reaching, if we want to say, late stage capitalism, where it's now we can't live in a world of infinite resources, but capitalism relies on infinite growth.
Yeah, it's the dream. Like, if you want to stump an economist, talk about limits.
Yeah.
Just, you know, and again, I remember being involved in a TV discussion where this economist, basically his answer to everything was substitutability, I think was the phrase he used. No matter what it is, we'll just find, when we've exhausted that, we'll find something else. So one of the other panelists kind of leaned over and said, so water, can you tell me what we're going to substitute water with? We've got a global water crisis. What are we going to substitute? What substance do you think we're going to replace water with? And he kind of looked a bit puzzled. That's what I mean, the extraordinary paucity. And this is something actually I find a real head wreck. Economists, these are the kind of modern high priests. These are the guys who are jamming in the Marion Finucane show and Sean O'Rourke. And they have literally become the new lay clergy, the people, the fonts of wisdom. And you actually listen for a minute to what they're saying and you go, what the hell kind of institution turns out what I would call idiot savants? These people with all the phraseology, all the terminology, and they don't know shit. I'm sorry. There may well be one or two economists out there listening who do. But if so, would they please come forward and introduce themselves? Because I've been looking and listening in horror at economists and even some of the really smart ones. And if I can give a name check, say David McWilliams, really smart guy. I remember interviewing David for an Irish Times article about 8 or 9 years ago. And I don't write the headlines, but they put the headline and said, McWilliams becomes a dedicated convert to ecology. And I thought, wow. We've got one of the big names in Irish public life has come across to it, right? This is 9 or 10 years ago. David McWilliams grasped that basically the game is up if we continue full steam ahead capitalism. Check back with David now. All forgotten. He's moved past having to notice limits. Because his economist part of his brain has kicked back in again. And now he's back basically to what he was doing 20 years ago. It's all forgotten about. Now, personally, I don't understand. Once you're exposed to ecological reality, you can't put that genie back in the bottle and say, oh yeah, okay, sure. Well, obviously we've hit limits in terms of emissions, in terms of resources, in terms of, you know, land use changes and so on. But who gives a shit? We'll just continue doing it. Mm. That doesn't make sense. And what I find people are dividing, you know, you're getting this kind of a schism in people's minds where smart guys, really smart guys like McWilliams, they know full well the hole we're in. And he actually produced a series at the time called Peak Everything. Mm. And he went around the world and he talked. And he even said, I think he's an asthmatic, if I remember correctly. And he said he was in places where he could hardly breathe. And he said, the penny finally dropped with me that everything's at risk. Mm. Now, when pennies drop, the law of gravity says the penny doesn't come back up again.
It doesn't bounce.
It doesn't bounce. And if it bounces, it doesn't bounce very high. But we've got these economists, the penny drops, and suddenly the penny magically defies gravity and is right back in their pocket again.
I am going to, this not to be a pile on to Dave McWilliams, but I thought it was a very dangerous phrase that he introduced to the Irish lexicon last year, where he said, we can't let the pretty good bully the perfect bully the pretty good. And I thought, oh my God, you've just given the vocabulary for people for keep going as we are, saying things are pretty good. And that's that was the phrase that he introduced. And I just thought it was a dangerous phrase because it neglected the climate issue. It neglected the housing issue. It neglected our problems in health. Just in this country alone, you know, some of the major crises, we said we have it pretty good. And I thought, yeah.
But you see, Tony, he's right. Mm. We do. Humans, to borrow a phrase from another generation, we've never had it so good. Mm. But the reason we as a species have never had it so good is that we've engaged in the greatest smash and grab in the history of this planet, never mind our species. One species has sequestered the resources of the entire biosphere. And we have turned those resources into, we've quarried the natural world for resources and shat out our pollution out the other end. We've seen the oceans filling up with plastics. We've seen the air is filling up with carbon dioxide and other gases, and the oceans are heating in ways that will continue to affect the climate. Even if every human magically disappeared tomorrow, the climate will continue to be affected by human actions already locked in for thousands of years.
Yeah.
We've tilted the whole Earth system into a new climatic era. And it's a climatic era that no humans have ever been involved in. And I'm sure you guys know this, but no humans up to us have ever been in a world where there were more than 300 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And carbon dioxide, as you know, is the key heat trapping gas. It's the perfect analog. It's the temperature gauge. So in all of human history, which is only about 200,000 years, we know, from ice cores, we know that in 800,000 years of Earth history, it has never exceeded 300. Now, as of the other day, we're at 414.
Yeah.
We've put an extra 40% of the key gas into the atmosphere that controls our temperature. So if you talk about tinkering with Earth systems, we've taken a 4-pound lump hammer to Earth systems. Now, what I find fascinating is people who think you can do that without consequences. Now, if we're having this discussion in Mozambique, we would know how sensitive the climate system is and how vulnerable humans are and how we've put ourselves at such extraordinary risk. And also, of course, there's, what are we now? 7.7 billion humans.
People, yeah.
And my other favorite head reckon statistic on this, which again, you guys may well be familiar with, is if you sort of go back 10,000 years ago, humans constituted about 1% of the animals on the surface of the planet. Well, let's exclude fish, just on the surface of the planet. We're about 1% of the animals at that time, maybe less. Now, right now, livestock are 60% of the animals of the mammals on Earth. Humans, about 36%. Our pets, maybe another 0.5%. All the wild vertebrate animals left in the world today constitute about 3-3.5%. we and our farmed animals are 97% or so. Now, how crazy is that? And people say, oh no, it's grand. I saw a nice nature program and there's lovely, you know, I saw some antelopes and a few zebras, right? The natural world is fucked. It is absolutely broken and shattered. And it's happened so fast. That's the thing. I mean, another statistic that one of my standard go-tos is, the year I went to start in primary school was 1970. So you take a 50-year period between that date and, say, next year. We've seen the population of all the wild animals in the world, all of them, decline by somewhere between 60 and 66%. So in 50 years, two-thirds of all life on Earth basically has disappeared. Yeah. Now, anyone who can recite that statistic and then unhear it and continue as if nothing's gone on and say, well, actually, what's really important is the economy. In my book, they're crazy.
Well, and I'll say this generation, and I mean everybody who's alive today, we have terraformed the planet. And when you look at it that way, mining by humans every year moves more sediment than all of the rivers, lakes, everything put together. Mining moves more. We are more than a force of nature. We surpass nature. And you were saying about population. If you look at the finite resource argument, the obvious solution for amoral capitalism is to reduce the amount of people. Not to reduce the consumption of resources. That's the amoral end of unlimited capitalism.
I don't think it's, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it's not going to work, because if you look at how consumption is spread, the poorest, say, 3 or 4 billion people are using very little resources. It is the top 1 or 2% that are over consuming phenomenally. In fact, if you took that analogy and chopped the other, if you chopped the top couple of percent off this, yes, we'd be halfway to solving this problem. The problem is that top 1% or 2% are very resistant to being chopped off.
Well, the top 10% consume 50%.
I think the numbers are even narrower than that.
And when you go to the top 1 or 2%, they are the massive users and the massive exploiters. Problem is that when you come back to something like a carbon tax, it is never going to capture the top 10%, the top 1%. It equalizes the risk across everybody. So the person at the bottom who is trapped, can't get an electric car. Not that we're saying electric cars with lithium ion batteries are the best solution. They're simply not. They are an interim solution. But the people who can't afford the change will pay most for the change. Those at the top, if you put in a carbon tax, it doesn't capture your 2-3 holidays, your weekend in Prague. It doesn't capture any of that.
Sure. Well, on that, I came up again as something I mentioned in an Irish Times article in January, and I had a chat with Mario Rosenstock about it on air, and he thought it was an interesting idea. And that was, I suggested that we give everybody in Ireland, and preferably further afield, connected to your PPS number, a ration of air miles. And I was suggesting, just to kick it off, let's say 1,500 kilometres a year. That's your ration. Mm. You get that at the normal price. Oh, and by the way, the normal price includes aviation being taxed, you know, fuels and so on, yes, like everything else. So at the new normal price. But every kilometre after that, you get hammered. Now, I believe, Martin, that begins to address your equity issue, because the person on the lower income, who are not the big flyers, by the way, yes, right? They can still have their, you know, pop over to wherever it is that they, maybe once a year. But the people who feel so important that they got to be flying 20 times a year, you know, I've got a big conference, I got a business meeting. Oh, you know, I need a break, right? These people who are jumping in planes and flying all over the world, popping over to New York for weekends, they need to be absolutely hammered, because the consequence of what they're doing. And if you want to compress human actions, there's no single discrete short-term human action that causes more long-term destruction than sitting on a jet aircraft.
Absolutely.
Nothing that you do. And also, in the world, 90% of the human beings on this planet have never and will never set foot in an aircraft. So I completely agree with you on the equity argument. But I believe if we had the political will, you could targeted by rationing and limits. And this is where we got to get away from it, because if you go, as you said, like just you know, simple things like carbon taxes, which broadly I'm in favor of, but unless you build in mechanisms to make sure that the big fish can't pass through the net, unless you build in equity, we're at nothing here. And my concern, I have many concerns, but probably my biggest concern in challenging this is that the people who are doing the best out of inequity are the ones who are resisting this change, but they're also the ones who've got their hands around the levers of power and around the genitalia of the people who are controlling the levers of power.
I think we've seen that, because we've seen with a government where we've, and I go back to it, and I know it's an awful thing that we keep repeating yourself, but on these pods, and I'm sorry to the listeners, but we have to think in terms of what happened around Irish water, how we were told you have to pay for Irish water or we risk EU fines. And all the time the clock was ticking down on climate 2020 fines that were going to kick in, and they never even gave them so much as a cursory glance, because that would have mean having to actually look at industry, look at agriculture, look at transport, and look at those areas where they have no interest of actually looking. Instead, what they'll do is they'll do a one week green week, greenwashing, whatever phrase you want to put on it. And we'll record Twitter videos showing that for this time, we're actually all going to go on an electric scooter into the Dáil for a few days or whatever the most recent cool thing to do is, you know?
Yeah, well, Leo, just as you know, he made a cool video there a few months back, which was down with the kids, and he featured Keep Cup.
Yeah.
And he told us about the staggering statistic about the number of millions of disposable coffee cups. Now, I was listening to it and thinking, okay, you know, it's pretty terrifying in 2019 that our Prime Minister thinks that Keep Cups have got, you know, anything to do much with anything. Just that's really terrifying. Second thing occurred to me, and maybe this is just me being a bit of a curmudgeon. Why is it that people can't, you know, go from one place to another, either in their car or on the road, without a disposable coffee cup? Mm-hmm. Or what is it that they need to be drinking all this coffee? I mean, I'm old enough to remember when I could actually go from my home to my place of work without popping off for a coffee. And, you know, with the remains of this will be around for thousands of years after me. So it's even the mindset. Nobody is prepared to say, actually, it isn't just what we do with our waste. Mm. It's the production of all the crap in the first place.
Well, I'll just, because it came up before here, we had a chat with somebody. 30 years ago, nobody walked around with a cup of coffee in their hands. 30 years ago, nobody did it. It is a new phenomenon.
Bottled water.
Exactly the same. It's not something that it's something that could disappear overnight and we could adapt quite well. That said, all your plastic cups, all your straws in the world, if you decide never to use another coffee cup, another straw, you are making zero difference. You are a spectator at the game, unless you tackle the big 100. And there are 100 companies out there that produce the vast majority of carbon, yet nobody's addressing them. There are, in fact, governments all over the world are terrified to address them. So how do we get past that obstacle?
Well, I can see you've set the bar pretty high. I suppose big capitalism has learned all kinds of valuable lessons from previous setbacks, including, you know, if you think back to the previous eras in history where, you know, when like Ancien Regime went too far and got decapitated and so on and so forth. So they've learned a lot of lessons about adaptation to threats. And I think one of the things they've learned is you control the public. It's much easier now to control what people think by simply hoovering up and buying up most of the media. The great majority of our media is now corporately controlled. I mean, directly corporately controlled. Yes. It's not even complicated to see the lines, right? And so you've got an entire media communication system that is serving a 0.01%. The interests of this tiny class. And obviously there are the vassals within that who recognize, even without being told, the interests of their proprietors. It's internalized. If you work, I can assure you, for Rupert Murdoch, you know exactly what side your butter is, your bread is buttered on. And you know as well that if you stray away from that, you're going to be not just unemployed, but probably unemployable.
Yeah.
And there's other people even closer to home who, of course, we won't mention, similarly, where people, they understand that you can't challenge here. And if you do, so I'm just saying that part of this has been, they've been really good at controlling messaging. Now, the other part, of course, is, and this is maybe the hard bit, that they're telling us what we want to believe. We, most of us, want to believe the fantasy, right? I'll be totally honest, lads. I want to believe the fantasy. There are times when I close my eyes, I think it's all a bad dream and that actually I'm the crazy one and everybody else is right and we can continue on. I mean that every now and again. Unfortunately, then I open my eyes again and go, no, that's not the case. We want to be fooled. You know, I think our ability to stay focused on this crisis, it's been, you've probably heard it described as this wicked problem. It's so difficult to keep a bead on this crisis because something else comes along. You know, you've got a family problem or a job crisis or a housing issue and it just, they seem more urgent. But I always think of Father Ted, small, far away, right? We're fooled by perception here. And this thing, a bit like a tiger, how a tiger stalks its prey slowly. Imperceptibly, until it reaches the point where the prey has no chance to escape. But when it's creeping on all fours towards you, it moves so slowly, the actual prey can see it, but they choose not to react because they say, I'm grand.
It's the
event horizon. You can't see the
I like the phrase. What is it? If you put a frog in a boiled pot, yeah. it'll jump out. If you turn on the heat and turn it up slowly.
Well, and we'll say that came from Grace Diaz's play where we're imagining the end of capitalism.
Yeah. Well, you've heard the phrase, by the way, lads. That it has been said that it's easier for people to imagine the end of the world sooner than the end of capitalism.
I don't buy into that narrative, and I don't buy into that narrative. I don't think it's that difficult to envisage a world that's not driven by greed. I don't think that's difficult. Our form of capitalism, our modern form of capitalism, is a little over 100 years old. So can we imagine times before that?
Can I come in there, Martin? See, I think capitalism is almost a rebrand of what the American settlers, the white people in America, called Manifest Destiny. Right? They arrived in and they went, okay, we'll drive the Indians out. And then it turns out actually there's gold in those hills. What will we do? We're after promising them those lands. You know what we'll say? God gave us this and we'll call it Manifest Destiny. And they formalized it. They legislated for it and they made it a contract, you know.
And as luck would have it, they also were the rule setters.
Yes, absolutely. You know, but they did sit down with them and tell them why they did it and explain to them.
That's right.
But neoliberalism has been an acceleration of these ideals. Yes. And it's ethno, or what do they call it? It's anarchistic capitalism.
Well, I'm glad that you're trying to pronounce that.
Anarcho-capitalism.
Anarcho-capitalism
is what I was trying to get to.
Yeah.
And it is anarcho-capitalism. Mm. It's astonishing. Mm. And it's astonishing that the Western world has so bought into it.
Yeah. And something that I find folks like me get accused of being often introduced on a program. For example, after the Primetime thing, Primetime put out a tweet and they said, you know, debate tonight between climate activist John Gibbons and IFA president Joe Healy. So, activist, president. Now, which sounds more like mainstream? And I just thought it was a wonderful piece of putting people in their box.
Framing,
exactly. Now, the reason I brought that up is to say that there's all kinds of activists. And I believe that we, like the true activists in our society and the true radicals, are not people out marching against climate change. I think I would consider those of us who hold this subject close to our hearts, we're conservatives with a small c. Mm-hmm. We want to conserve nature. We want to conserve the future for our kids. We're not radicals. The radicals are the guys who, knowing this, are burning down the world. Now, this is really crazy. And if I may do a very brief detour into some of the history of this, which fascinates me, 1978, one of the most senior scientists came to the board of Exxon and he said, lads, we've got a problem. We've done the science that you paid us to do. And it turns out that all this fossil fuel burning is changing the atmosphere. Now, Exxon, being smart, listened. One of the first things they did was they adjusted the heights of their oil rigs because to allow for sea level rise. And then 4 years later, another of their scientists came back and said, by the time climate change becomes obvious, the consequences become obvious, it may be too late. That was 1982. So Exxon had a huge thing to do. So what do? We got a brilliant idea, and they got all their friends together in the oil industry, and they said, right, we need to start spending serious money lying our asses off about this. And that's what they did. They headed a what they call a global climate coalition. They co-opted the language of activism to actually go out and lobby and fund, what do they call them, AstroTurf, fake grassroots organizations, media people, the whole thing. And all they needed to do, and this is what's so infuriating, it's so difficult to communicate climate science and so easy to disrupt that understanding. And they took the title from the playbook of the tobacco industry, and the key phrase is, doubt is our product. And as long we can take a ton of peer-reviewed research, and I can take an ounce of doubt, and I can neutralize a ton of research with an ounce of doubt. Yeah. And if that sounds crazy, I mean, imagine, you know, a vat of wine and you put in a spoon of shite. Now, what have you got? Yeah. You've got a vat of shite.
Yeah.
And they've corrupted our ability to understand science. Now, these guys, of course, they understand science. So when they were designing their rigs, they knew that they follow the rules of science. When they were, for example, making their plans for Arctic exploration, they factored in that in 20 years' time, the Northwest Passage would be more or less clear. So they completely understood the science, but they got their PR people to go out and lie their asses off. Now, if there's ever a Nuremberg situation in the future, I'll tell you, a lot of these guys are going to face a very, very grim reckoning for what they've done. And these are crimes against humanity on a scale that even the greatest conflicts of the 20th century pale into insignificance. Billions of people are going to pay with their lives for what these people have done.
Millions of people are dying already from air pollution every year.
Absolutely. But as I said, at the moment, it's reckoned that about 7 million people a year die from air pollution. In Ireland, and again, this is something I referenced in an article last week. In Ireland, we spend about 4 million euros, rightly so, by the way, through the Road Safety Authority, on promoting public behaviours about driving, right? And there's no question it has been effective over the years, right? But that is to save the lives that, well, let's say about 150 people died on the roads last year. Now, that we know of, about 1,200 people died in Ireland directly as a result of air pollution. 1,200. So you're talking effect close to a multiplier of 10, maybe 8. Now, we're not spending a rex, not a bean, on communicating to the public about domain climate change. Air pollution. Don't kill your neighbor.
Yeah.
Do not, you know, like open fires, coal burning, stoves, right? All of the, and wood burning as well, by the way. A lot of people think wood is great, friendly, environmentally recyclable, whatever. It's not. Wood burning stoves are a really effective way of killing your neighbours. But who wants to hear this?
Well, we import Colombian coal from one of the biggest, one of the worst mines on the face of the planet.
We sure do. And of course, I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. And that gets shipped up the Shannon, up the Foynes estuary, right into Money Point, right? And it's an absolute travesty. I think we're going to look back, if we get to look back on this era, and say, lads, were you mad? Now, I was looking at one of those weird BBC 4 documentaries one night, right? This was about model railways. Like, don't judge me. But part of it was old footage from Britain from the 40s and 50s. And they showed these steam trains. They were steam trains up until about 60s. Now, they're beautiful in their own weird way. But the thing that I was looking at was, my God, look at the filth out of these things. You'd see this train driving across the countryside, and for miles behind it, this instant cloud of filth. And I was looking at it and thinking, imagine the amount of air pollution that they were producing. Then scale it up 100 or 1,000-fold. And then you begin to look at what a plant like Money Point, one plant like Money Point, and then multiply that up by thousands of plants all over the world. And you say, lads, this is not good. We're in a tight corner here.
And the biggest open cast mine in Europe is in Germany.
Yes.
And
lignite.
Yeah, yeah. And they have destroyed, I think it's three villages they've taken out so far to keep this mine going. The biggest excavators on the planet. I mean, this is a thing to behold. It is a thing to behold. But they have actually terraformed. They have changed the landscape completely. And their solution, once they've mined all of this out, is we're just going to pour a load of water in there and make a lake out of it. And there is nothing to redress the balance. Nothing at all to redress the balance of what they're pulling out of there. Nothing.
No. And I mean, Germany is, to my mind, is a slightly tragic case because their chancellor, Merkel, is a physicist by training. And she, in a knee-jerk response to the Fukushima disaster in 2011, came up with this harebrained idea of phasing out nuclear. Now, some people have got some weird ideas about nuclear energy, about nuclear power, but by and large, nuclear power, where it's been deployed, has been incredibly successful and has kept enormous amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere, right? Now, it has its issues, of course, but I've always said they're engineering scale issues, they're manageable issues. The problem is, instead of that, but anyway, if you shut down a nuclear plant and replace it with a lignite plant, then that's crazy, but that's also weird and ideological. And especially when the person who actually pulls the button on that decision understands what they're doing. Mm. Because sometimes I try and cut politicians slack and say, you know, forgive them for they know not what they do. But when they do, it's really hard to take from my point of view. And, you know, in 2019, to be burning pretty much anything on an industrial scale is crazyville. We know that the space, the atmospheric space left for the next 1,000 or 5,000 years for anybody to burn anything is almost gone.
Yeah, we've even if we burn what we've already extracted, we're locking in whatever 3-4%. You know, we've locked in already 1.5, moving close over to the 2 mark. Yeah. But if we burn what we've already taken, never mind what the licenses we've granted to go and find more.
Yeah.
So that brings us to what should we be doing?
Well, first of all, I'll quote, we haven't got to her yet, and I'll quote the wonderful Swedish campaigner Greta Thunberg. She said the first thing we need to do is panic. And I think she's absolutely right. Anyone who isn't panicking about this doesn't understand the situation. And sometimes, like the emperor's new clothes, it takes the lack of guile of a kid to see right through the bullshit and call it exactly as it is. So where do we start? We start with panic. Panic. You know, I get a lot of people, by the way, who know more about communication than I do, lecturing me about language like this, saying, Gibbons, he's off again. Here you go. Frighten the horses. You know, why can't you be more reasonable, mate? You know, why can't you be more popular? Why can't you be more, you know, mainstream? And I say, fair enough. We each do it as best as we see it, as we call it as we see it. As I see it, I'm looking at 30 years of failed communication strategies. Enabling, optimism, hope.
Placating,
being reasonable has got us. It's like we're digging a hole, further and further down with all of these failed tactics. Now, my view is pretty simple. If you've tried all these things and they've all failed and you try them again and they fail again and then you try them again, don't call me crazy for rejecting these tactics. And saying, you know what, guys, just hear me out. How about we try scaring the shit out of people and see how that goes? Because we should.
Yeah.
I'm scared.
There was a recent interview, and I can't remember the name of the climate activist, and it will come back to me, you know. But he was the interviewer said to him that, you know, everything is grand outside the window. And the activist said that, you know, oh, do you remember the storm you had in November? And he said, yeah, that was one in every 500-year storm, isn't it? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah. And isn't that the third one you've had in the last 6 years?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah. And he went, so it's not fine. It's a nice day today. But he said, you were literally watching climate breakdown out that window over the last decade.
If we pull it back, just we'll say to the Irish situation. And we look at what has happened recently in Ireland. What are the positives that have come recently? The big positive that has come from what establishment would call the trots, the outliers, the leftists, the, and it was people's people for profits, keep it in the ground, Bill. And it's a very sensible. And if we could adopt that right across the planet, keep it in the ground, that has to be the very first step.
Yep.
But it was our traditional conservative, safe hands politics that balked against that and continues to balk against that, in that the traditional conservative politics is your real danger in this. It's your real danger. They can't be convinced otherwise. Like, people before profit had relied on that as an economic tenet of what they wanted to do in the future, was that the money for taking this stuff out of the ground was going to provide for what they wanted to, their vision of the future. But when the argument was made to them and they were told, look, this is what happens when you take it out of the ground, they felt they had no option but to change. But you put the same argument to our conservative politics and they say, oh no, we're taking it out of the ground. So how do we get around this? How do we square this circle?
Yeah, it's a tough one. And I think our politics is struggling because, you know, say, I think, and I would give total credit to, say, Breed Smith for the work that she's done. And I shared a platform with her recently at a meeting and, you know, very much stated that out loud. There's huge respect for the work that they've done. I'm a little more conflicted in the outright rejection on the left of all carbon taxes, because I'm going to put it out there. I think underlying it is there's a little teeny tiny thread in my book of populism, that it's playing to the gallery and it's taken easy options. I think we're no longer in the era where any of us can pick our favorite weapon. I think we're going to have rationing. We're going to have carbon taxes. We're going to have hard limits all over the place. And any party, left, right or center, that continues to peddle the notion that we can fix this, but it's not going to cost you anything and it's not going to inconvenience you, they're not being honest. And I understand politicians, they're in this existential bind. When they start telling the truth, it's like they start disappearing. You know that scene in Back to the Future where, you know, he's holding up and his family are vanishing from the photographs, right? Yeah. I appreciate that when politicians get honest, it doesn't boost their popularity. And, you know, and I'm a big fan of democracy. I think I'm sure we all are. I really am. And yet democracy places politicians in this impossible, invidious position, maybe better, of having to chase and court popularity, when sometimes what they actually have to do is say, lads, we've got a problem. We're your leaders. Here's what we propose. And the problem is, as soon as you do that as a leader, some other asshole jumps up and says, no, 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 that's not true at all. I reject that. And what I'm going to give you instead is the easy option. You can continue exactly as you are. And unfortunately, it takes a very sophisticated electorate to see past that.
It takes a sophisticated electorate. It also takes someone who can put across a vision. And the vision we get peddled these days are there's much more thought and spin and things that go into actual the cult of personality as opposed to what the vision for what the future should look like. I mean, when they launched one of the 2040 plans, there was hardly any sustainability built into most of the plans. I mean, it was just wasn't even thought about. It wasn't even built into it. Now we look at, you know, you mentioned the media. We look at Johnny Rowan and taking out ads in national newspapers. We have enough zoned land to build 414,000 dwellings, right? Adequate housing under the thing. But we're now looking at, where it was 52 apartments in Dunleary rat down are being converted into, we're going to be 208 bedsits, and we're saying we call it co-living.
Mm-hmm.
All of
hostels,
the,
yeah.
Hostels. Yeah, they're just, Orla Hegarty today referred to them to me as, millennial hubs,
that's
as
right.
opposed to the homeless hubs. We'll just call them millennial hubs. And she, you know, and that, and she's dead right. And if we accept that, what we're doing is we're accepting that these things, there is intersectionality. Don't think for a second that your health crisis isn't related to your housing crisis. Your housing crisis is also related to your climate crisis, our obsolescence, how things are built, how things are. We should be building passive certified houses. We should be building 20 to 30,000 of these a year. And we can build them actually bloody cheaper, than the costs we're paying for them at the moment, right? Like, go up the road. I always say it. Go up 1.5 miles up the road, and the O'Coolan houses are up there, guys. And he built them for 170,000. You know,
yeah.
That they're sitting there. This can be done. No, I don't want to be the guy that says, let's get all hope and all the rest of it, but let's get bloody active. Let's get doing it.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things that we've done so badly, like the, you know, simple stroke of the pen in planning regulations. For example, if you go back to about 2008, 2009, there was a change. I mean, I'll give the Greens this much when they did get in government. There's many things they failed on, but they succeeded hugely in changing the planning regulations to allow, leaving aside the issue of the bedsits and the hostels, but for a regular new build house now is minimum, I think it's A3 standard. Mm. This is a revolution in energy efficiency just by the stroke of a pen. Political will, focus, done. The shame was that they only really managed kind of very limited success, but I guess that's the nature of politics, especially when you're the small party. But it just shows it's as easy to build a well-built, well-insulated, comfortable, safe house as it is to build a pile of shit. Unfortunately, it's slightly more profitable to build for builders to build, you know, piles of rubble. And of course, we like, you know, thanks to our ideological sort of slant here, we're all in favor of light touch regulation, right? Light touch regulation has unfortunate people in apartment blocks now, and a pal of mine is one of them, who is being presented with, I think it's a €20,000 take it or leave it bill, right? The builder, who's long gone, built this apartment that he paid over the odds for, and then they come along to him and say, now you're going to have to pay €20,000 because it's either the fire problems or I think those plate glass windows have to be replaced, and it's his problem. Yeah. So we have again socialized the downsides of deregulation,
as we do,
while anarcho-capitalism.
Yeah. While the nameless, faceless developer sails off in the sunset, and I've no doubt he's living somewhere behind enormous electric gates, laughing his ass off.
Is there any country that's getting it right?
In terms of climate action, right? Strangely enough, if we pick a neighbouring country, Scotland.
Yes.
They've got the politics right on this. And some, a Scottish guy put it to me. He said that part of the reason we, the Scots, took this on was to kind of more or less, it was an internal competition with England. Mm. They kind of said, well, you're not doing much, so we'll do it. And they actually took it on. And they had 2020 targets of a 42% reduction. The Scottish Parliament signed up for a 42% reduction, 2020 emissions versus 2005. Now, we signed up for a 20% reduction, right? Yeah. We went for the absolute minimum available. So Scotland in 2015 hit 42%.
Wow.
They did it in 10 years. Then from there, so by 2020, they've simply pushed their targets out to, I think it's 55%, right? We, from 2005 to 2020, according to the EPA, at best will achieve 1%, right? And the only reason that we're even at minus rather than plus was we had a huge recession in the middle.
Yeah,
yes.
Without that recession, we would be at about plus 4 or 5. So it's political failure on an epic scale. And it runs right through so many organizations, so many, I mean, you know, for example, the chief scientific advisor to the state. Oh my God. You know, just again, I've written about this elsewhere, and I'll probably leave it at that. But I just go, I guess you get the advice that you want.
Yes,
you know, it's the best advice that fulfills what it is that you want to hear, right? And what I find again, over and over again, in public life and in our institutions, are full of people who are prepared, able people, but who can't see past the end of their nose. I mean, let's take, if we may, Bordenhamona as an example, right? This is a state-owned and controlled. In other words, we own and control it. And yet it's become this runaway Midlands monster. Now, apart from it being probably the most ecologically destructive organization in the history of the Irish state, leave that aside for a moment, it operates, there are three peat-burning plants, which are co-owned between them and the ESB. Mm. We, through the public service levy, are putting about 115 million a year in subsidies to keep these monsters open. Now, we did a back of the envelope calculation on the number of people employed in this particular farce versus the subsidies. Mm. And I worked out roughly that we're paying about €242,000 per employee to keep this circus on the road. So now, the employees are not getting the money, by the way.
Of course.
It's this loss-making shambles. But you've got a few politicians up in the Midland tub-thumping about it, right? And, oh, jobs, 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 right? Now, I mean, there are ways to create sustainable jobs that bring wealth to the community and don't destroy your surroundings. And then there's also jobs that actually make a living. But when we're doing the worst possible things and subsidizing it, you have to ask the question, what kind of skewed thinking, you know,
John,
gets there?
We spend $6 trillion in the world subsidizing these extractive companies. That's what we spend. It's $6 trillion. Mm. It's just madness. We're paying them to burn down the house.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing. I just kind of like just to bring this to a sort of a conclusion. We saw recently the UK Labour Party coming on board saying that they're on for a climate emergency. We've seen talk. We've mentioned Greta. We've seen how it's. We've also seen talk of saying, and it's I agree with you. Why should we back away from panic or fear or whatever you want to call it? Because the media and the politics use Project Fear all the time very effectively. Why should this be any different? The talk is we need to mobilize in ways that we haven't since World War II. Mm. And people can call that hyperbolic if they want, but it's not actually. It's what you need is cross border, cross country, cross continent agreements. China actually is a. There's an opportunity in China because I hate to say it, because they're not a capitalist economy. Mm. That if Xi Jinping chose to just do it, he could bloody well do it.
As a command economy, they're able to turn in a sixpence.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Democracy is it's more like a millipede. You've got to get all those little feet doing the same thing, except it's like a millipede with 1,000 brains and very difficult to align it up and very, very slow. Having said that, I wouldn't like to live in China.
No, and I have to say.
And I know you wouldn't either.
Are we hearing things?
Surveillance society.
Surveillance is
horrible.
Have they large Muslim internment camps building up now?
I was reading about that recently. It's absolutely terrifying. And they're exporting their surveillance technology all over the world. So, as I say, I'm going to stick with democracy because it's the least sucky system out there.
Is it that we are going to have to reach the point where, and I know lives are being lost, but let's be very honest about this. They are not nice, white, middle-class lives that are being lost.
Yeah. It's far away. Yeah.
When we get to the point where it's middle-class lives being lost, is that where we see the change?
Maybe. Yeah. I think you're right. And you see these surges of panic in Ireland, for example, after the latest flooding disaster. We haven't had one now for a little while, but, you know, don't you worry. Mm. There's one coming up pretty soon. You'll get the surge. And I watch the spike of interest and my phone starts ringing from, you know, oh, you must come in and talk about this. A week, 10 days. It's all, you know, once the waters recede, it's gone again.
Yes.
So, and on the other hand, there's parts of the world now that are getting hammered constantly around the clock. And I think, it's only when they begin to, maybe it's when it becomes real to us. But I do believe that by the time it has become utterly real to all of us, you know, white looking people, it'll be way, way past any point where any intervention that us white looking people might decide to make will be well gone. But I will say, if I may, that, you know, I know I've taken a slightly gloomy pitch here, but I have been incredibly inspired by the children's strike movement, including, you know, me and my kids were involved in the one in March. There was 15,000 people on the street in Dublin, 5,000 in Cork, all over the place. It was the best feeling I've had in my heart in such a long time. Also the Extinction Rebellion, we occupied O'Connell Bridge. It was only for a few hours, a week or two ago. Again, incredibly inspiring what the Extinction folks have done in London. Very impressive. What we need, peaceful mass resistance, but mass resistance. We're going to have to sit down and say, you can't, this has got to stop. But it has to be peaceful because the other side are just itching to break some skulls. So, you know, we don't want to go down and make the mistakes of the fascists. We don't want to be giving the state reason to persecute, you know, climate protesters.
I'd be only delighted to say there is a sinister fringe.
Precisely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I think it's got to be an incredibly well-disciplined movement. And in fact, again, I was at a talk the other night where one of the organizers explained the ethos behind the peaceful movement and how effective it is and how it disarms people who want to demonize and marginalize movements like this. And also we've got to bring, you know, we've got to break out and bring a lot of people with us, and you don't bring people with you by, you know, by behaving, as I said, in a way that frightens, you know, kind of regular people. I mean, I know I said about panic, but frightening people is the kind of stuff that fascists do. And we need to be absolutely not going down that route.
May 24th is the next climate strike, I think.
That's right. It's a Friday again. It's a little unfortunate because it's, first of all, it's the day of the general, of the European and local elections, mm-hmm. which is a messy kind of day. And secondly, it means it's a day off school.
Yeah.
So a lot of those kids will be out of the school loop. So I'd be a little concerned. Now, having said that, you know, hopefully it will be. I mean, it's just coincidence because it's a global day. Mm. So it just happens to have fallen that way in Ireland. But I think, you know, one of the things that inspired me the most was I spent a good bit of time back in November 2017 attending the Citizens Assembly deliberations on climate change in Malahide. And just to be in a room with 100 ordinary citizens who had no axe to grind and listen to them debate, you know, how do we get here? Where do we go next? And it was really funny because I was sitting with the media people and just behind me were all the lobbyists. And I know half them, mostly ag guys. And they were circling around and they were circling around and they were on their mobile phones. They were scribbling, but they didn't have the floor. They didn't have the microphone. Mm. And at the end of this process, we came up, the committee or the assembly came up with 13 recommendations. And everybody went, holy shit, the Irish public actually cares. When the lobbyists are kept out of the room, when the bullshit artists are kept out of the room and they're informed by experts, what you come up with is we showed it. And the same Citizens Assembly showed that the Irish public on the Eighth Amendment was years ahead of, you remember the fuss about, oh, the Citizens Assembly must be rigged because they're saying that there's this huge appetite for a liberal regime, a European style regime in Ireland. That's ridiculous. It had to be fixed.
You're doing it
wasn't.
Wrong.
Exactly. You're getting the wrong answers. And I was so inspired. In fact, I know in the UK now, they're looking towards the Irish Citizens Assembly model as a way of, what do they call it? Deliberative democracy, where you find out the answers by, you know, that it's not just a squabble as to who's got the best lobbyists. Mm-hmm. And so much in Ireland comes down to this.
Yes.
You know, I've had in the 10 years that I've been at it, the amount of access I've had, say, to environment ministers is close to zero. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in people like me. Quite the opposite. On the other hand, the president of the IFA, it's embarrassing. They're on speed dial with these guys. And I see them at events and they're the best of buddies. Mm. And you see, that's grand. But the question is, who do they serve? Mm. Do politicians believe that they come to serve lobbyists? I don't believe they do. And it's very hard to remind the politicians. They kind of think, oh, once every 5 years, I got to run the gauntlet of the bloody public. But the rest of the time, I'm working for lobbyists. We got to change that because that is what has poisoned democracy.
Well, Simon McGarr put it to us quite well. He said there are two buttons in each department. There is the red button and there is the green button. The green button gets you publicity, photo shoots. The red button says, stop what you're doing.
Mm.
And politicians are trained to press the green button. It's a reward system. Press the green button, press the green button. And the green button is what the lobbyists
want. Well, Mark, can we actually use that analogy and change it to press the green button as in the green initiative?
I was almost with you there for thinking, God, they're pressing the green initiative button, Martin.
It's the opposite.
No, what our green button is short for the green wash button.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. We're great. As I said, whether it's Keep Cups or other, or smart farming is my favorite. Right. Like we will do anything except anything that matters.
Hmm.
You name it, we'll do it. As long as it is completely ineffective, we're on board.
And it's the same with housing. It's this, you know, we will pump money in via HAP. We'll pump money in via rent allowance supplements. We'll pump money in to actually subsidize developers, but we won't build a bloody house.
I have to say this, because it's present and it's here, this election and the issue about election posters.
Yes.
And so much coverage on election posters. It makes not a jot of difference. It's the same as the plastic straws thing. You're only a spectator at the game. If the posters actually elect somebody who cares about climate change and actually achieve something, they are worth every cent to be there.
Yeah, I agree. And also, I'm one of those people who thinks that, you know, it's good that we have visibility for a few weeks of the democratic process.
Yeah.
And if you're a new candidate and you need to get known, you get your mug up on the poster. And it's otherwise it favors the incumbent.
Yes.
The people who are on the TV every night. Mm. Whereas the new people coming through, and by God, we need new people coming through. And again, what I've seen talking to quite a few young climate, and I mean really young climate activists, we have a new generation of young politicians that are going to blow your mind.
Yeah.
Radical, socially responsible and conscious, democratic, but they're kick ass. They're not interested in the bullshit.
Yeah.
They, you know, and this is, goes back to the Greta Thunberg effect. They know they've been lied to on a epic scale. They're not interested. And once you wake from that dream, then change, dare I say it, is possible.
Mm. Red pill, blue pill. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. That was a really informative discussion. I think we're going to have you back again in the future. I definitely think so.
Well, thank you, Martin. Thank you, Tony.
John, I really appreciate it. Folks, I'm gonna put out a shout for patrons. We are in a situation here where this costs money to put out. This costs us, you know, time, effort, and all the rest of it. And there's, you know, it's rewarding to meet great guests, but it's actually financially draining to keep it going.
Yeah, I'm going to do a Bob Geldof and it's, give us the fucking money, please.
Go on to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Give us the price of a cup of coffee. It really makes a difference. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.